to the Archive Room podcast. First am I, I'm Judith Lay, and I'm very pleased to find you waiting for me at the door to the Archive Room, the place where we keep stories of island life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. So come on in, sit down and make yourself comfortable, and let's listen to this week's selection. The Manx language isn't something that we've talked about very much in the Archive Room, so that's our first stop this week, with a fascinating conversation that I hope shows how things have actually improved over the years. Victor Neal, CBE, was a Manx politician who during his distinguished career was Education Minister and Speaker of the House of Keys. He was born in 1918, and when we first met him in an earlier programme, he painted a wonderful picture of his childhood when days were never long enough for all the fun a youngster could have, growing up in Douglas around the busy harbour in a town full of great characters. Today, Victor is back, this time with his wife Thelma, and with David Collister, they're chatting about the Manx language in general and some of the words and phrases that are part of their everyday vocabulary. And as you listen, it's well worth remembering that this conversation was recorded about 25 years ago. And so, let's welcome Thelma and Victor Neal, who tell David they also have another name.
The Douglas Butties. Where Douglas Butties?
Butties.
Butties, yes.
No idea how it originated, but that's what we were always known as, the Douglas Butties.
My father had Manx-speaking parents who also spoke English, but they wouldn't speak the Manx to the children. Mm. But I think my father must have had sharp ears because he picked up a fair amount,
yeah. You
see. So a few words that we picked up in our time with Dad, you see. Well, my mum used this one, and it was a slew. I had a brother, and she'd say, now, just let's see if your slew is right, you see.
Your hair?
Your hair. I used to think it was the parting, but I was talking to Bernard Kane, and he said, no, there's a joiner's tool called a slew, and that was for smoothing, rather like a plane. And so he said that would mean that the hair was smooth. A brock, which means you've made a bit of a mess. I went up to see an aunt of mine who was married to my father's brother, and she asked me to cut the bread. Well, I'm left-handed, and she just said, oh, will you cut the bread, please, Thelma? Well, I should have told you that I was kithiggy. To be a kithig is left-handed.
Is it?
Yes. I can't cut bread yet. And so she came in and she said, dear me, she said, you've made an awful brock of the loaf, she said.
That was in circulation when I was a kid as well,
yes.
I think. Yeah.
Yes, brock. Well, now, and Risty, if something had just gone off, you know, in the days before fridges and that, bacon or butter, yeah. We used to go risty. Well, it meant it had gone over slightly, it had gone off. Then the xiaozhig, that's a woman, a scolding woman, a woman with a sort of sharp tongue, yes. Father McKillia, that's often used, you know.
What?
You're all Father McKillia, you're all in a bit of a mess, you know.
I thought you meant a Catholic priest for a minute. Father McKillia?
Father McKillia, I don't know how you spell it. I suppose the Killia is the same as the name. But Father, I don't know, I've just done it phonetically,
yeah. Which
I think would be a good idea for your news announcers, because,
yes.
You know, they do put their foot in it with us Manxies, you know.
What's the worst thing they've done lately?
Say Dalby instead of Dorby, and Ballarack one day. Oh, dear, dear, dear.
Ballarack, that was desperate, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was desperate. So I feel, you know, and the likes of the farm, which is always when the Mills Baldwin thing, Cam Lurk was coming over regularly. Yeah. Well, it's Cam Lurk.
I told them it was Cam Lurk, and Terry Kringle's always stuck to that.
Yes,
but then there seem to be two pronunciations.
Yes.
And it's the same as Glenfaber and Glenfarber.
Yes.
You can't be sure you're right.
Well, let Vic have a little turn now.
Right, well, I should not use the word blatherskite in connection with any politician at all, should I?
Well, it refers to a few, but
The common ones would be Tredaluwa, wouldn't they, I suppose, time enough. Of course, in the folklore, we've had all this stuff coming to us as children, more they do, and for no reason, all that sort of thing.
Yes, they're something that everybody should know about, and normally they get the pronunciation right. But a story about my brother, he was living down at Bognor Regas, and he had a boat, and he christened it the Fanadri, and he was keeping it in a marina there. And when he was coming in, the fella on the side would be shouting to all the others by their boat names, but when he would come to try and pronounce Fanadri, he used to just shout out, "Come in, Mr. Neil."
There's glister. To give someone glister means to give them a good telling off, to give them glister. There was one, Gerood, someone that was in a real Gerood, and they were in a real fix, you know. I suppose they'd got everything, dishes piled up and everything going, and so they were in a bit of a Gerood.
My mother used to use that.
Yes, a Gerood. Yeah. It's a good expressive one, isn't it?
And the other one, of course, we use so often is yisser, and I can't really find any proper definition of that.
No, it's one we've used ever since we were kids, and it's just like the saying, "How you doing, boy?" But you say, "How you doing, yisser?"
Will you be having pridders and herring?
Well, we used to have them, yes. My father worked till about 8 o'clock at night, so on a Friday night he'd come home and just have a cup of tea and then go back to the shop to work, and then Mum would have a big, these big iron pots, you know, with potatoes in the skins. She'd scrub the skins, and you have those and herring put on top, and you cut onion and soak that in vinegar.
Yeah.
And that was a meal on a Friday night with good butter on the spuds, you know.
Yes, so, I remember somebody coming to our cottage at Balafria when I was a kid, who had the very same thing, and not only ate the potatoes and the meat off the fish, but the bones as well.
Yes, and stockfish. Would you remember the stockfish hanging outside grocers' shops? It was dried cod, really, and you soaked it, and then, by Jove, it was still salty after all that.
Now, let's see, where do we go from here now? Over the bridge, yes. Well, a different dialect altogether over the bridge.
Yes, well, this is where people get a bit confused when they talk about over the bridge these days. They think it's the ferry bridge down near Ballasalla, but actually the expression over the bridge means going over the stone bridge at the top of Douglas Harbour, because that was the road to the south of the island. That's the old Castletown Road, is known as now. But when you were going over that bridge, you were going to the south, so the people from the south were the ones from over the bridge.
What about fat as a mollig?
As fat as a mollig, well, that is the float that they used in these ships in days gone by to stop them banging against the next boat in port, and they were bladders of animals, presumably pig or sheep, and they would be blown up, and so they would be as fat as a mollig then. Also, the scutch, and another word, I'll give you a good scutch if you don't behave yourself, you see, to a child who'd been naughty. A spithig, I believe, was the smallest in, say, a litter of pigs or cats or dogs would be.
Well, you'd refer to a small child as a spithig. A little spithig of a thing.
Now, I've used this, I don't know whether it's Manx or not, a drillane, someone that's dreamy and doesn't get out of her own way. Uh-huh. But there's another one as well, ligamathre, that's got to be more guttural, ligamathre. It's someone who just lets the hours go by, you know, again, laid back, I suppose, really. Uh-huh. And strugan, of course, you know what that means, don't you?
No.
Well, when you're scraping your feet along, you're not picking your feet on, you're just strugan your feet along the ground.
Gullah's gargan is going and grumbling.
Well, when you were the Speaker of the House of Keys, of course, they were referring to you in Manx there, and there's Maister Lorder, and now more terms are creeping into Tynwald, mainly from Peter Cowan and Hazel Hannum.
Yeah, well, I think they want to concentrate more on the English, because everybody will understand them then, because it's bad enough understanding some of them when they're speaking English.
There's still quite a few expressions in your generation, but how long can they hold, do you think?
Well, as long as we keep saying them. If we're not careful, it's Manx radio, and if you're going to let it keep going, then everything will get anglified. So you try your best to keep the Manx flavour going. So you've got full marks.
Oh, right. But you're right, it will be lost. And, I mean, language does develop, but it's nice to hang on to these things, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. I'll just have to say to both of you, Guramai, if it's right.
Evi, David.
Thelma and Victor Neal chatting some 25 years ago with David Collister about the Manx language. And happily, thanks to our present Manx Language Development Officer Ruth Kegin-Gell and many other Manx speakers over those last 25 years, the security and the future of the Manx language is assured. Now we're heading down south. If you've ever visited the Sound Cafe or walked around in that area, I wonder if you've ever gazed at the Calf of Man and wondered what it would be like to live there. Not just visit it, to actually live there. Well, we're about to get a fascinating insight. But the man who's going to tell the story really didn't have any choice about being there. He's Leslie Garrett, who was born in 1932. But let's begin by listening to Leslie telling us a little about his father, Robert, who grew up in Sulby in the early 1900s.
My father lived down the Clannock Road, and the actual place that they lived in was actually a cowhouse to start with. And then Kelly Brothers Kirkmichael thatched it, and then 20 years afterwards they lifted it. Before that, my father, Uncle Alfie, Uncle Henry lived in the henhouse. At really? The side of it. Uncle Alfie lived in a galvanised shed alongside, and I've got a photograph of him when he come home from the Navy, outside with his vest on, having a shave. That's how they brought up. Now you wouldn't see it, but I've got a photograph somewhere off the actual cottage. Mm. It's still on the same angle down the Clannock Road. It's the third building down on the Clannock Road, and it's right on the side of a lane there, and that's where they lived.
Robert Garrett started his working life on farms. In the mid-1930s, he saw a job advertised for farm work in the south of the island, only to discover, when he'd got it, that the farm in question was on the Calf of Man. And that was how Robert Garrett became the steward of the Calf of Man, and in 1936 moved there with his wife and young family. Leslie Garrett, who was about 3 and a half at the time of the move, takes up the story in conversation with David Collister.
It was Robert Garrett, he was a steward, 3 children.
I was the oldest, then Michael, then Maureen, and then the other girl that was born on the calf was Violet.
Yeah.
And the certificate I've just shown you, that was Kathleen. That
so there were two born on the calf?
Yes, two. And no doctors.
Where's the midwife?
My father. When he was asked, how did he know how to bring a child in, like, yeah, and because he tied the biblical cord himself with a navy knot, apparently, with a figure of eight and cut it. And he said, well, the birth of a cow, he said, was 9 months, and he said he didn't think there was any difference. That's how he put it, but when people were reading it, he thought he was pretty crude, like, but that's how he put it.
So you'd be there from about three and a half to near on 7 years of age. Well, what happened with your education then?
My education wasn't really so good, to tell you the truth. I may say, and I finished before my 14th birthday.
But you couldn't go to school from the calf, could
you? No, oh
no. Your mother and father wouldn't have time to teach you much, either.
Not really. The only thing my mother was teaching me was songs and lullabies.
Oh, right.
I knew, and they're old too, lullabies. Like, well, at the end of the programme, I might give you one.
I look forward to that. Now, you'd be too young to remember all the details of this, but what sort of buildings would be on the calf then? We know about the farmhouse, and presumably there'd be outbuildings with that.
Well, there was the stable, which was more or less alongside the kitchen, where you come out for the kitchen, and then looking square off it, the cowhouses were down the left-hand side, and then it was like a square yard. In the left-hand corner where you went out the square yard, there was the place where all the batteries were, you know, from the windmill. Charging the batteries there.
There was a windmill?
Yeah, and there was also a corn thrasher there as well.
One of the old circular
mills.
Yeah,
with a horse going round.
That would be out of use, though, would it?
No, that was in use there.
Was it?
More or less, yes, in use when my dad was there, yes. And then you went through the cow house at the side of the thrashing mill, and that's where the horses were going round.
Yeah.
And if you go there today, you can see that stone that was there. And then the hen house was alongside of that, and then just down of that was where all the batteries were charged.
You're telling me here then we've got a working farm, you've got a corn mill that's getting used, so there must have been corn, there must have been then the means of reaping it.
There's a binder on, I've got photographs of that.
That was presumably there before your father got there, was it?
I would say so, but I think it would belong to Mr. Popperwell. Oh, he was a previous owner, but whether he had somebody working for him then, I have no idea.
Wasn't there also an old car?
There was an old car there that my father used to tinker about. I don't think he ever got it going, but he was always tinkering with it, you know. I always remember I would be about six or six and a half, and he would stand me up on a box. He made me put my fingers on the plugs, and he would be turning, and he would be going, tut-tut-tut-tut-tut, there's nothing happening here, and then he'd see my finger, he'd give me a shock, and then I wouldn't go back, I'd go running in the house.
So your father then was doing all the farm work on his own? Then?
More or less, yes. There's nobody, except when he got his brother to come in the summertime, maybe to help him with the cutting of the corn.
He'd have a horse then?
There was at least three, because he had to take two up on the plough. On the top.
Now, how did you get your supplies then?
My father used to go once a fortnight across, and I can remember on one occasion, and this is when the motorboat that was on the calf, which was left there by Popperwell, it got knocked out of the boathouse by a big storm, and we lost the motorboat. The last year, I think, my father was rowing. We were a fortnight or 3 weeks without food. Of course, there was plenty of eggs and stuff like that. But one of the things my father did, I don't know whether you remember, but you know how you get this stuff called Uvica? It's like a cornflake, but it's what you feed cattle and the hens
that. Yeah.
And it's a shape like cornflake.
Right.
My father put that in boiling water to get all the brand out of it.
Yeah.
And he made that into a thin cake. And that's what we had. You had to go with our egg or whatever. There's nothing else.
Was there running water there or not?
Yes, there was. I think it come out of a big tank.
The rainwater.
Yeah. And electric.
Electricity.
Electric was on as well. That was caused by the big windmill and generator.
Your generator,
in 1938.
Own, yeah.
The blades all broke on that in 1938, so we just had oil lamps to start with.
And what did you do then for power? Just only oil lamps?
Just oil lamps. And then there was also a telephone on. Telephone lights to start with. That went in the storm. So after that, there was no length. But when you come to look at it, when he did go on there, he really didn't have any experience of electricity or boatmanship. It was only like Ned Madrill that gave him all that when he went on, and he was very good to Dad. He came on quite a lot, apparently. He came on and showed him different things.
You wouldn't get many visitors, would you?
Occasionally. My mother used to do an odd tea and all. There would be occasional visitors brought in, yes. I don't know who done that. I think it might be Madrill or somebody that done that. Certainly wasn't my father, like he didn't have any time to take the boat and go across and whatnot. I think it was probably like today, trips brought in.
You were telling me a marvellous thing about a horse that had decided to eat some green corn.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Bruett Lake, which is a young corn about 2 inches high, and my uncle was over at the time, and the horse was lying sort of on its side, couldn't get up because it was full of wind.
What, had it been eating the corn?
Eating the corn, eating the Bruett, and it was my father come out and saw it there, and then he got my uncle to sit on it, and he jabbed it with the pitchfork, and it was running around the blooming field, making the noises.
Dispatching its wind, was it?
It was quite loud, and I can remember it, and it was bit of a laugh, I think, to me. And Uncle Henry was petrified on the horse. And then another occasion, my father brought the horse in to give it water, tied it up a bit, and my mother was in the kitchen, and I'd come out, and I was hanging to the horse's leg. I'd be about four. Of course, my mother come out, shouted. My father just said, "Oh, leave him, he'll be all right. The horse will not touch him." And sure enough, I walked away, had enough of holding the horse's leg and come away, and then I got me bottom tanned.
You didn't get a kick from the horse?
No, nothing. On another occasion, my father goes for provisions. And I followed him down, unknowns to him, goes down to the sound end and was playing in the water then, the tide coming in. So my Uncle Henry was there that time, but I got scutched with a stick. And then the ship that went aground there called the Mary Burra, I don't really know whether that went aground while we were on or while it was already there, but I can remember him bringing a box about 18 inches by a foot high, and it had two sets of drawers in it and a lid that opened like that. Now, all in the top was the needles, the stitching, and everything, iodine, gentry of violet, all that in it. So when that was brought and any of us got a cut, my mother wouldn't say go and get the medicine chest. She would say go and get the Mary Burra.
Yeah.
That's what she said. Every time that somebody was cut, she'd give us a dab of the gentry violet or the iodine, which we didn't like. It was probably strong stuff in them days. And that's what she called it, the Mary Burra. That was off the boat. That was in the captain's thing in the boat, or the skipper of the boat. My father brought ropes up, block and tackle, and lots of that stuff is buried up in Ballymanock Hackett. When we had to move from there and my mother went into the guest home, all that stuff we had to get rid of. So my brother got a digger, dug a big hole and buried it all in.
Your mother must have been quite a tough woman to be able to live and work down there in the Calf.
Well, she was really. She came from Yarmouth. She was of a seafaring family. In her younger days, her father was a sailor. I think he eventually was in the Royal Navy and then he jumped ship in New Zealand. And then he was pardoned for the First World War and came back, and he was on sailing ships after that. And then because of the conditions, with I think there was five of a family altogether, and he was at sea that often, my mother's mother ended up on the gin. Because at that time, my mother had to go into a home. She went in a Catholic home. And that's how mother learned all her bits and pieces, was from the nuns. So she was there until 18, which they asked her then, you know, you'd get the chance of becoming a nun if you wanted it. My mother didn't. She went into domestic work.
Yeah.
And she came to the Isle of Man at 19, and that's when she met Dad.
Yeah.
She was a barmaid in the Sulby Glen. Wasn't nothing my mother couldn't do, but she did tell me on one occasion that she'd done something when she was in the nun's place, got into trouble, and they'd forgot about it, and she was left standing from 8 o'clock at night till 8 o'clock the next morning in the hall.
Really?
And she said it was hard going there. She said, I don't know how the children would cope today, she said, if they had the discipline that was given there by the nuns.
Yeah.
She said they were quite strict. But my mother, she could do anything. She also could sing lullabies. This is one of them. And from what I know, it's very old and it starts.
Gentle moon that gives us light through the darkness of the night, will you kindly tell us, pray, where you go to in the day? In your starry nest, do you ever rest?
Good night, Mr. Moon. I shall have to go and leave you. Good night, Mr. Moon. Come again and see me soon. And when you're asleep, through the window pane you'll peep. You'll wake up and call out, good night, Mr. Moon.
And Leslie Garrett was absolutely right. Good night, Mr. Moon is a lullaby from the early 1900s. What a precious memory. And I'll have more memories, traditions, fascinating and funny stories to share with you when we meet at the archive room door at the same time next week. But for now, let's turn off the lights and close the door. Don't forget, you can find all the programmes in the previous series of the Archive Room by subscribing for free to the Archive Room podcasts at manxradio.com or via your usual podcast provider. I'm Judith Leigh, saying thank you for listening and wishing you a very good evening. The sound of your